Let me confess that I was somewhat resentful of Cyrus's apotheosis. It should have been me, I even thought. I am the magic child. Not only my primacy at home, but even my true innermost nature has now been purloined. Padma, I never became a Mahaguru. Millions have never seated themselves at my feet. And it was my own fault, because one day many years ago, I had gone to hear Cyrus's lecture on the parts of a woman's body. What? Padma shakes her head puzzled. What's this now? The nuclear physicist Dubash possessed a beautiful marble statuette, a female nude, and with the help of this figurine, his son would give expert lectures on female anatomy to an audience of sniggering boys. Not free. Cyrus the Great charged a fee. In exchange for anatomy, he demanded comic books, and I, in all innocence, gave him a copy of that most precious of Superman comics, the one containing the Frame story about the explosion of the planet Krypton and the rocket ship in which Jor-El, his father, dispatched him through space to land on Earth and be adopted by the good, mild Kents. Did anybody else see it? In all those years, did no person understand that what Mrs. Dubash had done was to rework and reinvent the most potent of all modern myths, the legend of the coming of the Superman? I saw the hoardings trumpeting the coming of Lord Khusro Khusrovan Bhagwan, and found myself obliged, yet again, to accept responsibility for the events of my turbulent, fabulous world. How I admire the leg muscles of my solicitous Padma! There she squats, a few feet from my table, her sari hitched up in fisherwoman fashion. Calf muscles show no sign of strain, thigh muscles rippling through sari folds display their commendable stamina. Strong enough to squat forever, simultaneously defying gravity and cramp, my Padma listens unhurriedly to my lengthy tale. Oh, mighty pickle woman! What reassuring solidity, how comforting an air of permanence in her biceps and triceps, for my admiration extends also to her arms, which could wrestle mine down in a trice, and from which, when they enfold me nightly in futile embraces, there is no escape. Past our crisis now, we exist in perfect harmony. I recount, she is recounted to. She ministers, and I accept her ministrations with grace. I am, in fact, entirely content with the uncomplaining thews of Padma Mungrily, who is, unaccountably, more interested in me than my tales. Why I have chosen to expound on Padma's musculature. These days, it's to those muscles, much as to anything or one, for instance, my son, who hasn't even learned to read as yet, that I'm telling my story. Because I'm rushing ahead at breakneck speed, errors are possible, and overstatements, and jarring alterations in tone. I'm racing the cracks, but I remain conscious that errors have already been made, and that, as my decay accelerates, my writing speed is having trouble keeping up, the risk of unreliability grows. In this condition, I'm learning to use Padma's muscles as my guides. When she's bored, I can detect in her fibres the ripples of uninterest. When she's unconvinced, there is a tick which gets going in her cheek. The dance of her musculature helps to keep me on the rails, because in autobiography, as in all literature, what actually happened is less important than what the author can manage to persuade his audience to believe. Padma, having accepted the story of Cyrus the Great, gives me the courage to speed on. Into the worst time of my 11-year-old life, there is, was, worse to come, into the August and September when revelations flowed faster than blood. Nodding signboards had scarcely been taken down when the demolition crews of the Nalaka women moved in. Buckingham Villa was enveloped in the tumultuous dust of the dying palaces of William Methold. Concealed by dust from Warden Road below, we were, nevertheless, still vulnerable to telephones. And it was the telephone which informed us, in the tremulous voice of my Aunt Pia, of the suicide of my beloved Uncle Hanif. Deprived of the income he had received from Homi Katrak, my uncle had taken his booming voice and his obsessions with hearts and reality up to the roof of his Marine Drive apartment block. He had stepped out into the evening sea breeze, frightening the beggars so much when he fell that they gave up pretending to be blind and ran away yelling. In death as in life, Hanif Aziz espoused the cause of truth and put illusion to flight. He was nearly 34 years old. Murder breeds death. By killing Homi Katrak, I had killed my uncle too. It was my fault. And the dying wasn't over yet. The family gathered at Buckingham Villa. From Agra, Adam Aziz and Reverend Mother. From Delhi, my uncle Mustafa, the civil servant who had polished the art of agreeing with his superiors to the point at which they had stopped hearing him. Which is why he never got promoted, and his half-Iraini wife Sonia and their children, who had been so thoroughly beaten into insignificance that I can't even remember how many of them there were. And from Pakistan, Bitter Alia, and even General Zulfikar and my Aunt Emerald, who brought 27 pieces of luggage and 2 servants, and never stopped looking at their watches and inquiring about the date. Their son Zafar also came, and to complete the circle, my mother brought Pia to stay in our house, at least for the 40-day mourning period, my sister. For 40 days we were besieged by the dust. Dust creeping under the wet towels we placed around all the windows. Dust slyly following in each morning arrival. Dust filtering through the very walls to hang like a shapeless wraith in the air. Dust deadening the sounds of formal ululation and also the deadly sniping of grieving kinsfolk. The remnants of Methil's estate settled on my grandmother and goaded her towards a great fury. They irritated the pinched nostrils of punchinello-faced General Zulfikar and forced him to sneeze onto his chin. In the ghost haze of the dust, it sometimes seemed we could discern the shapes of the past, the mirage of Leela Sabarmathy's pulverized pianola, or the prison bars at the window of Toxi Katrak's cell. Dubash's nude statuette danced in dust form through our chambers, and Sonny Ibrahim's bullfight posters visited us as clouds. The Nalaka women had moved away while bulldozers did their work. We were alone inside the dust storm, which gave us all the appearance of neglected furniture, as if we were chairs and tables which had been abandoned for decades without covering sheets. We looked like the ghosts of ourselves. We were a dynasty born out of a nose, the aquiline monster on the face of Adam Aziz, and the dust, entering our nostrils in our time of grief, broke down our reserve, eroded the barriers which permit families to survive. In the dust storm of the dying palaces, things were said and seen and done from which none of us ever recovered. It was started by Reverend Mother, perhaps because the years had filled her out until she resembled the Sankara Acharya mountain in her native Srinagar, so that she presented the dust with the largest surface area to attack. Rumbling up from a mountainous body came a noise like an avalanche, which, when it turned into words, became a fierce attack on Aunt Pia, the bereaved widow. We had all noticed that my mummy was behaving unusually. There was an unspoken feeling that an actress of her standing should have risen to the challenge of widowhood in high style. We had unconsciously been eager to see her grieving, looking forward to watching an accomplished tragedienne orchestrate her own calamity, anticipating a 40-day raga in which bravura and gentleness, howling pain and soft despond, would all be blended in the exact proportions of art. But Pia remained still, dry-eyed, and anticlimactically composed. Amina Sanai and Emerald Zulfikar wept and rent their hair, trying to spark off Pia's talents. But finally, when it seemed nothing would move Pia, Reverend Mother lost patience. The dust entered her disappointed fury and increased its bitterness. "That woman, what's his name?" Reverend Mother rumbled. "Didn't I tell you about her? My son, Allah, he could have been anything, but no, what's his name? She must make him ruin his life. He must jump off a roof, what's his name, to be free of her." It was said, could not be unsaid. Pia sat like stone. My inside shook like cornflour pudding. Reverend Mother went grimly on. She swore an oath upon the hairs of her dead son's head. Until that woman shows my son's memory some respect, what's his name, until she takes out a wife's true tears, no food will pass my lips. It is a shame and scandal, what's his name, how she sits with antimony instead of tears in her eyes. The house resounded with this echo of her old wars with Adam Aziz. And until the 20th day of the 40, we were all afraid that my grandmother would die of starvation, and the 40 days would have to start all over again. She lay dustily on her bed. We waited and feared. I broke the stalemate between grandmother and aunt, so at least I can legitimately claim to have saved one life. On the 20th day, I sought out Pierre Aziz, who sat in a ground-floor room like a blind woman. As an excuse for my visit, I apologized clumsily for my indiscretions in the Marine Drive apartment. Pierre spoke after a distant silence.
"Always melodrama," she said flatly. "In his family members, in his work, he died for his hate of melodrama. It is why I would not cry."
At the time, I did not understand. Now I'm sure that Pierre Aziz was exactly right. Deprived of a livelihood by spurning the cheap thrill style of the Bombay cinema, my uncle strolled off the edge of a roof. Melodrama inspired, and perhaps tainted, his final dive to earth. Pierre's refusal to weep was in honour of his memory. But the effort of admitting it breached the walls of her self-control. Dust made her sneeze. The sneeze brought tears to her eyes. And now the tears would not stop, and we all witnessed our hoped-for performance after all, because once they fell like Flora Fountain, and she was unable to resist her own talent. She shaped the flood like the performer she was, introducing dominant themes and subsidiary motifs, beating her astonishing breasts in a manner genuinely painful to observe. Now squeezing, now pummeling, she tore her garments and her hair. It was an exaltation of tears, and it persuaded Reverend Mother to eat. Dal and pistachio nuts poured into my grandmother, while salt water flooded from my aunt. Now Nazim Aziz descended upon Pierre, embracing her, turning the solo into a duet, mingling the music of reconciliation with the unbearably beautiful tunes of grief. Our palms itched with inexpressible applause. And the best was still to come, because Pierre, the artiste, brought her epic efforts to a superlative close. Laying her head in her mother-in-law's lap, she said in a voice filled with submission and emptiness,
"Ma, let your unworthy daughter listen to you at last. Tell me what to do. I will do."
And Reverend Mother tearfully,
"Daughter, your father Aziz and I will go to Rawalpindi soon. In our old age, we will live near our youngest daughter, our Emerald. You will also come, and a petrol pump will be purchased."
And so it was that Reverend Mother's dream began to come true, and Pierre Aziz agreed to relinquish the world of films for that of fuel. My uncle Hanif, I thought, would probably have approved. The dust affected us all during those 40 days. It made Amit Sanai churlish and raucous, so that he refused to sit in the company of his in-laws, and made Alice Pereira relay messages to the mourners, messages which he also yelled out from his office. "Keep the racket down! I'm working in the middle of this hullabaloo!" It made General Zulfikar and Emeril look constantly at calendars and airline timetables, while their son Zafar began to boast to the brass monkey that he was getting his father to arrange a marriage between them. "You should think you're lucky," this cocky cousin told my sister. "My father is a big man in Pakistan." But although Zafar had inherited his father's looks, the dust had clogged up the monkey's spirits, and she didn't have the heart to fight him. Meanwhile, my Aunt Alia spread her ancient, dusty disappointment through the air, and my most absurd relatives, the family of my uncle Mustafa sat sullenly in corners and were forgotten as usual. Mustafa Aziz's moustache, proudly waxed and upturned at the tips when he arrived, had long since sagged under the depressive influence of the dust. And then, on the 22nd day of the mourning period, my grandfather, Adam Aziz, saw God. He was 68 that year, still a decade older than the century, but 16 years without optimism had taken a heavy toll. His eyes were still blue, but his back was bent. Shuffling around Buckingham Villa in embroidered skullcap and full-length chugger coat, coated too in a thin film of dust, he munched aimlessly on raw carrots and sent thin streaks of spittle down the grizzled white contours of his chin. And as he declined, Reverend Mother grew larger and stronger. She, who had once wailed pitifully at the sight of mercurochrome, now appeared to thrive on his weakness, as though their marriage had been one of those mythical unions in which succubi appear to men as innocent damsels, and after luring them into the matrimonial bed, regain their true awful aspect and begin to swallow their souls. My grandmother, in those days, had acquired a moustache almost as luxuriant as the dustily sagging hair on the upper lip of her one surviving son. She sat cross-legged on her bed, smearing her lip with the mysterious fluid which set hard around the hairs, and was then ripped off by a sharp, violent hand. But the remedy only served to exacerbate the ailment. "He has become like a child again, what's his name?" Reverend Mother told my grandfather's children. "And Hanif has finished him off." She warned us that he had begun to see things. "He talks to people who are not there," she whispered loudly, while he wandered through the room, sucking his teeth. "How he calls out, what's his name, in the middle of the night!" And she mimicked him. "Ho Tai, is it you?" She told us children about the boatman, and the hummingbird, and the Rani of Kuchnaheen. "Poor man has lived too long, what's his name. No father should see his son die first." And Amina, listening, shook her head in sympathy, not knowing that Adam Aziz would leave her this legacy, that she too, in her last days, would be visited by things which had no business to return. We could not use the ceiling fans for the dust. Perspiration ran down the face of my stricken grandfather and left streaks of mud on his cheeks. Sometimes he would grab anyone who was near him and speak with utter lucidity.
"These Nehrus will not be happy until they have made themselves hereditary kings."
Or, dribbling into the face of a squirming General Zulfikar,
"Ah, unhappy Pakistan! How ill-served by her rulers!"
But at other times he seemed to imagine himself in a gemstone store and muttered,
"Yes, there were emeralds and rubies."
The monkey whispered to me, "Is Grandpa going to die?" What leaked into me from Adam Aziz? A certain vulnerability to women, but also its cause, the hole at the centre of himself caused by his, which is also my, failure to believe or disbelieve in God. And something else as well, something which, at the age of 11, I saw before anyone else noticed. My grandfather had begun to crack.
"In the head?" Padma asks. "You mean in the upper story?"
The boatman Tai said,
"The ice is always waiting, Adam Baba, just under the water's skin."
I saw the cracks in his eyes, a delicate tracery of colourless lines against the blue. I saw a network of fissures spreading beneath his leathery skin. And I answered the monkey's question. "I think he is." Before the end of the 40-day mourning period, my grandfather's skin had begun to split and flake and peel. He could hardly open his mouth to eat because of the cuts in the corners of his lips, and his teeth began to drop like flitted flies. But a crack death can be slow, and it was a long time before we knew about the other cracks, about the disease which was nibbling at his bones. So that finally his skeleton disintegrated into powder inside the weather-beaten sack of his skin. Padma is looking suddenly panicky.
"What are you saying? You, mister? Are you telling that you also? What nameless thing can eat up any man's bones? Is it..." No time to pause now. No time for sympathy or panic. I have already gone further than I should. Retreating a little in time, I must mention that something also leaked into Adam Aziz from me. Because on the 23rd day of the mourning period, he asked the entire family to assemble in the same room of glass vases, no need to hide them from my uncle now, and cushions and immobilized fans. The same room in which I had announced visions of my own. Reverend Mother had said, "He has become like a child again." Like a child, my grandfather announced that 3 weeks after he'd heard of the death of a son whom he had believed to be alive and well, he had seen with his own eyes the God in whose death he had tried all his life to believe. And, like a child, he was not believed, except by one person.
"Yes, listen," my grandfather said, his voice a weak imitation of his old booming tones. "Yes, Rani, you are here, and Abdullah? Come, sit. Nadir, this is news. Where is Ahmed? Alia will want him here. God, my children. God, whom I fought all my life. Oscar? Ilsa? No, of course I know they are dead. You think I'm old, maybe foolish, but I have seen God."
And the story, slowly, despite rambles and diversions, comes inching out. At midnight, my grandfather awoke in his darkened room. Someone else present, someone who was not his wife. Reverend Mother snoring in her bed, but someone, someone with shining dust on him, lit by the setting moon. And Adam Aziz,
"Ho, Tai, is it you?"
And Reverend Mother mumbling in her sleep,
"Oh, sleep, husband, forget this."
But the someone, the something cries in a loud, startling and startled voice,
"Jesus Christ Almighty!"
Amid the cut glass vases, my grandfather laughs apologetically, he, for mentioning the infidel name.
"Jesus Christ Almighty!"
And my grandfather looking and seeing, yes, there are holes in his hands, perforations in the feet, as there once were in a... But he is rubbing his eyes, shaking his head, saying,
"Who? What name? What did you say?"
And the apparition startling, startled, "God! God!" And after a pause,
"I didn't think you could see me."
"But I saw him," my grandfather says beneath motionless fans. "Yes, I can't deny it. I surely did."
And the apparition?
"You're the one whose son died."
And my grandfather, with a pain in his chest,
"Why? Why did that happen?"
To which the creature, made visible only by dust,
"God has his reasons, old man. Life's like that, right?"
Reverend Mother dismissed us all.
"Old man doesn't know what he means, what's his name. Such a thing, that grey hair shouldn't make a man blaspheme."
But Mary Pereira left, with her face pale as bedsheets. Mary knew whom Adam Aziz had seen, who, decayed by his responsibility for her crime, had holes in hands and feet, whose heel had been penetrated by a snake, who died in a nearby clock tower and had been mistaken for God. I may as well finish my grandfather's story here and now. I've gone this far, and the opportunity may not present itself later on. Somewhere in the depths of my grandfather's senility, which inevitably reminded me of the craziness of Professor Schapstecker upstairs, the bitter idea took root that God, by his offhand attitude to Hanif's suicide, had proved his own culpability in the affair. Adam grabbed General Zulfikar by his military lapels and whispered to him,
"Because I never believed he stole my son."
And Zulfikar,
"No, no, Dr. Saab, you must not trouble yourself so."
But Adam Aziz never forgot his vision, although the details of the particular deity he had seen grew blurred in his mind, leaving behind only a passionate, drooling desire for revenge, which lust is also common to us both. At the end of the 40-day mourning period, he would refuse to go to Pakistan, as Reverend Mother had planned, because that was a country built especially for God. And in the remaining years of his life, he often disgraced himself by stumbling into mosques and temples with his old man's stick, mouthing imprecations and lashing out at any worshipper or holy man within range. In Agra, he was tolerated for the sake of the man he had once been. The old ones at the Cornwallis Road pawn shop played hit the spittoon and reminisced with compassion about the Dr. Saab's past. Reverend Mother was obliged to yield to him for this reason, if for no other. The iconoclasm of his dotage would have created a scandal in a country where he was not known. Behind his foolishness and his rages, the cracks continued to spread. The disease munched steadily on his bones, while hatred ate the rest of him away. He did not die, however, until 1964. It happened like this. On Wednesday, December 25th, 1963, on Christmas Day, Reverend Mother awoke to find her husband gone. Coming out into the courtyard of our home, amid hissing geese and the pale shadows of the dawn, she called for a servant and was told that the Dr. Saab had gone by rickshaw to the railway station. By the time she reached the station, the train had gone. And in this way, my grandfather, following some unknown impulse, began his last journey, so that he could end his story where it and mine began, in a city surrounded by mountains and set upon a lake. The valley lay hidden in an eggshell of ice. The mountains had closed in to snarl like angry jaws around the city on the lake. Winter in Srinagar, winter in Kashmir. On Friday, December 27th, a man answering to my grandfather's description was seen, chugger-coated, drooling in the vicinity of the Hazratbal Mosque. At 4:45 on Saturday morning, Haji Mohammed Khalil Ghani noticed the theft from the mosque's inner sanctum of the valley's most treasured relic, the holy hair of the Prophet Muhammad. Did he? Didn't he? If it was him, why did he not enter the mosque, stick in hand, to belabour the faithful as he had become accustomed to doing? If not him, then why? There were rumours of a central government plot to demoralise the Kashmiri Muslims by stealing their sacred hair, and counter-rumours about Pakistani agent provocateurs who supposedly stole the relic to foment unrest. Did they? Or not? Was this bizarre incident truly political, or was it the penultimate attempt at revenge upon God by a father who had lost his son? For 10 days, no food was cooked in any Muslim home. There were riots and burnings of cars. But my grandfather was above politics now, and is not known to have joined in any processions. He was a man with a single mission. And what is known is that on January 1st, 1964, a Wednesday, just 1 week after his departure from Agra, he set his face towards the hill which Muslims erroneously called the Takht-e-Sulaiman, Solomon's Seat, atop which stood a radio mast, but also the black blister of the temple of the Acharya Sankara. Ignoring the distress of the city, my grandfather climbed, while the cracking sickness within him gnawed patiently through his bones. He was not recognised. Dr. Adam Aziz, Heidelberg returned, died 5 days before the government announced that its massive search for the single hair of the Prophet's head had been successful. When the state's holiest saints assembled to authenticate the hair, my grandfather was unable to tell them the truth. If they were wrong, but I can't answer the questions I've asked. Arrested for the crime and later released on grounds of ill health was one Abdul Rahim Bond. But perhaps my grandfather, had he lived, could have shed a stranger light on the affair. At midday on January 1st, Adam Aziz arrived outside the temple of Sankara Acharya. He was seen to raise his walking stick. Inside the temple, women performing the rite of puja at the Shiva Lingam shrank back, as women had once shrunk from the wrath of another tetrapod-obsessed doctor. And then the cracks claimed him, and his legs gave way beneath him as the bones disintegrated, and the effect of his fall was to shatter the rest of his skeleton beyond all hope of repair. He was identified by the papers in the pocket of his chugger coat. a photograph of his son, and a half-completed and, fortunately, correctly addressed letter to his wife. The body, too fragile to be transported, was buried in the valley of his birth. I am watching Padma. Her muscles have begun to twitch distractedly. Consider this, I say. Is what happened to my grandfather so very strange? Compare it with the mere fact of the holy fuss over the theft of a hair, because every last detail of that is true, and by comparison, an old man's death is surely perfectly normal. Padma relaxes. Her muscles give me the go-ahead. Because I've spent too long on Adam Aziz, perhaps I'm afraid of what must be told next. But the revelation will not be denied. One last fact. After the death of my grandfather, Prime Minister Jawaharlal Nehru fell ill and never recovered his health. This fatal sickness finally killed him on May 27, 1964. If I hadn't wanted to be a hero, Mr. Zagalo would never have pulled out my hair. If my hair had remained intact, Glandy Keith and Fat Purse wouldn't have taunted me. Marcia Mijovic wouldn't have goaded me into losing my finger, and from my finger flowed blood which was neither alpha nor omega and sent me into exile, and in exile I was filled with the lust for revenge which led to the murder of Homi Katrak, and if Homi hadn't died, perhaps my uncle would not have strolled off a roof into the sea breezes, and then my grandfather would not have gone to Kashmir and been broken by the effort of climbing the Sankara Acharya Hill. And my grandfather was the founder of my family, and my fate was linked by my birthday to that of the nation. And the father of the nation was Nehru, Nehru's death. Can I avoid the conclusion that that, too, was all my fault? But now we're back in 1958, because on the 37th day of the mourning period, the truth, which had been creeping up on Mary Pereira, and therefore on me, for over 11 years, finally came out into the open. Truth in the shape of an old, old man, whose stench of hell penetrated even my clogged-up nostrils, and whose body lacked fingers and toes, and was littered with boils and holes, walked up our two-story hillock and appeared through the dust cloud to be seen by Mary Pereira, who was cleaning the chick blinds on the veranda. Here, then, was Mary's nightmare come true. Here, visible through the pall of dust, was the ghost of Joe Da Costa, walking towards the ground-floor office of Amit Sanai. As if it hadn't been enough to show himself to Adam Aziz, "Arre, Joseph!" Mary screamed, dropping her duster. "You go away now! Don't come here now! Don't be bothering the Saabs with your troubles! Oh, God, Joseph, go, go now! You will kill me today!" But the ghost walked on down the driveway. Mary Pereira, abandoning chick blinds, leaving them hanging askew, rushes into the heart of the house to throw herself at the feet of my mother. Small, fat hands join in supplication. Begum Sahiba, forgive me. And my mother, astounded. What is this, Mary? What has got your goat? But Mary is beyond dialogue. She is weeping uncontrollably, crying, "Oh, God, my hour has come. My darling madam, only let me go peacefully. Do not put me in the jailkhana." And also, "11 years, my madam. See if I haven't loved you all. Oh, madam, and that boy with his face like the moon. But now I am killed. I am no good woman. I shall burn in hell. Fantouche!" cried Mary, and again, "It's finished! Fantouche!" Still, I did not guess what was coming, not even when Mary threw herself upon me. I was taller than her now. Her tears wet my neck. "Oh, Baba, Baba, today you must learn a thing, such a thing I have done. But come now." And the little woman drew herself up with immense dignity. "I will tell you all before that Joseph does. Begum, children, all you other great sirs and madams, come now to Saab's office, and I will tell." Public announcements have punctuated my life. Amina in a Delhi gully and Mary in a sunless office. With my whole family trooping amazedly behind us, I went downstairs with Mary Pereira, who would not let go of my hand. What was in the room with Ahmed Sinai? What had given my father a face from which jinns and money had been chased away and replaced by a look of utter desolation? What sat huddled up in the corner of the room, filling the air with a sulphurous stench? What, shaped like a man, lacked fingers and toes, whose face seemed to bubble like the hot springs of New Zealand, which I'd seen in the Wonder Book of Wonders? No time to explain, because Mary Pereira has begun to talk, gabbling out a secret which has been hidden for over 11 years, pulling us all out of the dream world she invented when she changed name tags, forcing us into the horror of the truth. And all the time she held on to me, like a mother protecting her child. She shielded me from my family, who were learning, as I was, that they were not. It was just after midnight, and in the streets there were fireworks and crowds, the many-headed monster roaring. I did it for my Joseph, Saab. But please don't send me to jail. Look, the boy is a good boy, Saab. I am a poor woman, Saab. One mistake, one minute in so many years, not jail Khana, Saab. I will go. 11 years I gave, but I will go now, Saab. Only this is a good boy, Saab. You must not send him, Saab. After 11 years, he is your son. Oh, you boy, with your face like the sun coming out. Oh, Salim, my piece of the moon, you must know that your father was Winky and your mother is also dead. Mary Pereira ran out of the room. Ahmed Sinai said, in a voice as far away as a bird, "That in the corner is my old servant Musa, who tried to rob me once." Can any narrative stand so much so soon? I glance towards Padma. She appears to be stunned, like a fish. Once upon a time, there was a servant who robbed my father, who swore he was innocent, who called down upon himself the curse of leprosy if he should prove a liar, and who was proved to be lying. He had left in disgrace. But I told you then he was a time bomb, and he returned to explode. Musa had, indeed, contracted leprosy, and had returned across the silence of the years to beg for my father's forgiveness, so that he could be released from his self-inflicted curse. Someone was called God who was not God. Someone else was taken for a ghost and was not a ghost. And a third person discovered that, although his name was Salim Sinai, he was not his parents' son. "I forgive you," Ahmed Sinai said to the leper. After that day, he was cured of one of his obsessions. He never tried again to discover his own and wholly imaginary family curse. "I couldn't tell it any other way," I say to Padma. "Too painful. I had to just blurt it out, all crazy-sounding, just like that."
"Oh, mister," Padma blubbers helplessly. "Oh, mister, mister."
"Come on now," I say. "It's an old story. But her tears aren't for me, for the moment. She's forgotten about what chews at bones beneath the skin. She's crying over Mary Pereira, of whom, as I've said, she had become excessively fond."
"What happened to her?" she says with red eyes. "That Mary?"
I am seized by an irrational anger. I shout, "You ask her! Ask her how she went home to the city of Panjim in Goa, how she told her ancient mother the story of her shame. Ask how her mother went wild with the scandal. Appropriately enough, it was a time for old folk to lose their wits. Ask, did daughter and old mother go into the streets to seek forgiveness? Was that not the one time in each 10 years when the mummified corpse of St. Francis Xavier, as holy a relic as the prophet's hair, is taken from its vault in the Cathedral of Bom Jesus and carried around the town? Did Mary and old distraught Mrs. Pereira find themselves pressing up against the catafalque? Was the old lady beside herself with grief for her daughter's crime? Did old Mrs. Pereira shouting, 'Hi! Hi! 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 Hi!' clamber up onto the bier to kiss the foot of the Holy One? Amidst uncontrollable crowds, did Mrs. Pereira enter a holy frenzy? Ask, did she or didn't she, in the clutches of a wild spirit, place her lips around the big toe on St. Francis's left foot? Ask for yourself, did Mary's mother bite the toe right off?
How?
Padma wails, unnerved by my wrath. How? Ask! And is this also true? Were the papers making it up when they wrote that the old lady had been miraculously punished, when they quoted church sources and eyewitnesses who described how the old woman was turned into solid stone? No? Ask her if it's true that the church sent a stone statue figure of an old woman around the towns and the villages of Goa to show what happened to those who misbehave with the saints. Ask, was this statue not seen in several villages simultaneously? And does that prove fraud or a further miracle?
You know I can't ask anyone,
Padma howls. But I, feeling my fury subside, am making no more revelations tonight. Boldly, then, Mary Pereira left us and went to her mother in Goa. But Alice Pereira stayed. Alice remained in Amitsanai's office and typed, and fetched snacks and fizzy drinks. As for me, at the end of the mourning period for my uncle Hanif, I entered my second exile. Movements performed by Pepper Potts. I was obliged to come to the conclusion that Shiva, my rival, my changeling brother, could no longer be admitted into the forum of my mind, for reasons which were, I admit, ignoble. I was afraid he would discover what I was sure I could not conceal from him, the secrets of our birth. Shiva, for whom the world was things, for whom history could only be explained as the continuing struggle of oneself against the crowd, would certainly insist on claiming his birthright, and, aghast at the very notion of my knock-kneed antagonist replacing me in the blue room of my childhood while I, perforce, walked morosely off the two-story hillock to enter the northern slums, refusing to accept that the prophecy of Ram Ram Seth had been intended for Winky's boy, that it was to Shiva that prime ministers had written, and for Shiva that fishermen pointed out to sea, placing, in short, a far higher value on my 11-year-old sonship than on mere blood, I resolved that my destructive, violent alter ego should never again enter the increasingly fractious councils of the Midnight Children's Conference. That I would guard my secret, which had once been Mary's, with my very life. There were nights at this time when I avoided convening the conference at all, not because of the unsatisfactory turn it had taken, but simply because I knew it would take time and cold blood to erect a barrier around my new knowledge, which could deny it to the children. Eventually, I was confident I would manage this. But I was afraid of Shiva. Most ferocious and powerful of the children, he would penetrate where others could not go. At any rate, I avoided my fellow children. And then suddenly it was too late, because having exiled Shiva, I found myself hurled into an exile from which I was incapable of contacting my more than 500 colleagues. I was flung across the partition-created frontier into Pakistan. Late in September 1958, the mourning period for my uncle Hanif Aziz came to an end, and, miraculously, the dust cloud which had enveloped us was settled by a merciful shower of rain. When we had bathed and put on newly washed clothes and switched on the ceiling fans, we emerged from bathrooms filled, briefly, with the illusory optimism of freshly soaped cleanliness, to discover a dusty, unwashed Amitsanai, whiskey bottle in his hand, his eyes rimmed with blood, swaying upstairs from his office in the manic grip of gins. He had been wrestling, in his private world of abstraction, with the unthinkable realities which Mary's revelations had unleashed. and owing to some cockeyed functioning of the alcohol, had been seized by an indescribable rage, which he directed neither at Mary's departed back nor at the changeling in his midst, but at my mother, at, I should say, Amina Senai. Perhaps because he knew he should beg her forgiveness and would not, Ahmed ranted at her for hours within the shocked hearing of her family. I will not repeat the names he called her, nor the vile courses of action he recommended she should take with her life. But in the end, it was Reverend Mother who intervened.
"Once before, my daughter," she said, ignoring Ahmed's continuing ravings, "your father and I, what's his name, said there was no shame in leaving an inadequate husband. Now I say again, you have, what's his name, a man of unspeakable vileness. Go from him, go today, and take your children, what's his name, away from these oaths which he spews from his lips like an animal, what's his name, of the gutter. Take your children, I say, what's his name, both your children," she said, clutching me to her bosom. Once Reverend Mother had legitimized me, there was no one to oppose her. It seems to me now, across the years, that even my cursing father was affected by her support of the 11-year-old snot-nosed child. Reverend Mother fixed everything. My mother was like putty, like potter's clay in her omnipotent hands. At that time, my grandmother, I must continue to call her that, still believed that she and Adam Aziz would shortly be emigrating to Pakistan. So she instructed my Aunt Emerald to take us all with her, Amina, the monkey, myself, even my Auntie Pia, and await her coming. "Sisters must care for sisters, what's his name," Reverend Mother said, "in times of trouble." My Aunt Emerald looked highly displeased, but both she and General Zulfikar acquiesced. And, since my father was in a lunatic temper which made us fear for our safety, and the Zulfikars had already booked themselves on a ship which was to sail that night, I left my lifelong home that very day, leaving Ahmed Senai alone with Alice Pereira, because when my mother left her second husband, all the other servants walked out too. In Pakistan, my second period of hurtling growth came to an end. And in Pakistan, I discovered that somehow the existence of a frontier jammed my thought transmissions to the more than 500, so that, exiled once more from my home, I was also exiled from the gift which was my truest birthright, the gift of the midnight children. We lay anchored off the Rann of Kutch on a heat-soaked afternoon. Heat buzzed in my bad left ear, but I chose to remain on deck, watching as small, vaguely ominous rowing boats and fishermen's dhows ran a ferry service between our ship and the Rann, transporting objects veiled in canvas back and forth, back and forth. Below decks, the adults were playing housey-housey. I had no idea where the monkey was. It was the first time I'd ever been on a real ship. Occasional visits to American warships in Bombay Harbour didn't count, being merely tourism. And there was always the embarrassment of being in the company of dozens of highly pregnant ladies who always came on these tour parties in the hope that they would enter labour and give birth to children who qualified by virtue of their seaborne birth for American citizenship. I stared through the heat haze at the Rann, the Rann of Kutch. I'd always thought it a magical name, and half feared, half longed to visit the place, that chameleon area, which was land for half the year and sea for the other half, and on which, it was said, the receding ocean would abandon all manner of fabulous debris, such as treasure chests, white ghostly jellyfish, and even the occasional gasping freak legendary figure of a merman. Gazing for the first time upon this amphibian terrain, this bog of nightmare, I should have felt excited. But the heat and recent events were weighing me down. My upper lip was still childishly wet with nose goo, but I felt oppressed by a feeling of having moved directly from an overlong and dribbling childhood into a premature, though still leaky, old age. My voice had deepened,
I had been forced to start shaving, and my face was spotted with blood where the razor had sliced off the heads of pimples. The ship's purser passed me and said, "Better get below, son. It's the hottest time just now." I asked about the ferrying boats. "Just supplies," he said, and moved away, leaving me to contemplate a future in which there was little to look forward to, except the grudging hospitality of General Zulfikar, the self-satisfied preening of my Aunt Emerald, who would no doubt enjoy showing off her worldly success and status to her unhappy sister and bereaved sister-in-law, and the muscle-headed cockiness of their son Zafar. "Pakistan," I said aloud, "what a complete dump!" And we hadn't even arrived. I looked at the boats. They seemed to be swimming through a dizzying haze. The deck seemed to be swaying violently as well, although there was virtually no wind. And although I tried to grab the rails, the boards were too quick for me. They rushed up and hit me on the nose. That was how I came to Pakistan, with a mild attack of sunstroke to add to the emptiness of my hands and the knowledge of my birth. And what was the name of the boat? What two sister ships still plied between Bombay and Karachi in those days before politics ended their journeys? Our boat was the SS Sabarmati. Its sister, which passed us just before we reached the Karachi harbour, was the Sarasvati. We steamed into exile aboard the commander's namesake ship, proving once again that there was no escape from recurrence. We reached Rawalpindi by hot, dusty train. The General and Emerald travelled in air-conditioned. They bought the rest of us ordinary first-class tickets. But it was cool when we reached Pindi, and I set foot for the first time in a northern city. I remember it as a low, anonymous town. Army barracks, fruit shops, a sports goods industry, tall military men in the streets, jeeps, furniture carvers, polo. A town in which it was possible to be very, very cold, and in a new and expensive housing development, a vast house surrounded by a high wall which was topped by barbed wire and patrolled by sentries, General Zulfikar's home. There was a bath next to the double bed in which the general slept. There was a house catchphrase, "Let's get organized." The servants wore green military jerseys and berets. In the evenings, the odours of bhang and charas floated up from their quarters. The furniture was expensive and surprisingly beautiful. Emerald could not be faulted on her taste. It was a dull, lifeless house for all its military airs. Even the goldfish in the tank set in the dining room wall seemed to bubble listlessly. Perhaps its most interesting inhabitant was not even human. You will permit me for a moment to describe the general's dog, Bonzo. Excuse me, the general's old beagle bitch. This goitered creature of papery antiquity had been supremely indolent and useless all her life. But while I was still recovering from sunstroke, she created the first furore of our stay, a sort of trailer for the revolution of the pepper pots. General Zulfikar had taken her one day to a military training camp, where he was to watch a team of mine detectors at work in a specially prepared minefield. The general was anxious to mine the entire Indo-Pak border. "Let's get organized," he would exclaim. "Let's give those Hindus something to worry. We'll blow their invaders into so many pieces there'll be no damn thing left to reincarnate." He was not, however, overly concerned about the frontiers of East Pakistan, being of the view that "those damn blackies can look after themselves." And now Bonzo slipped her leash, and somehow, evading the frantically clutching hands of young Jawans, waddled out into the minefield. Blind panic! Mine-detecting soldiers picking their way in frenzied slow motion through the blasting zone. General Zulfikar and other army brass diving for shelter behind their grandstand, awaiting the explosion. But there was none. And when the flower of the Pakistan army peeped out from inside dustbins or behind benches, it saw Bonzo picking her way daintily through the field of the lethal seeds, nose to ground. Bonzo the insouciant, quite at her ease. General Zulfikar flung his peaked cap into the air.
"Damn marvellous!"
he cried in the thin voice which squeezed between his nose and chin.
"The old lady can smell the mines!"
Bonzo was drafted forthwith into the armed forces as a four-legged mine detector, with the courtesy rank of Sergeant Major. I mention Bonzo's achievement because it gave the General a stick with which to beat us. We, Sinais and Pierre Aziz, were helpless, non-productive members of the Zulfikar household, and the General did not wish us to forget it.
"Even a damn 100-year-old beagle bitch can earn her damn living," he was heard to mutter. "But my house is full of people who can't get organized into one damn thing."
But before the end of October, he would be grateful for, at least, my presence, and the transformation of the monkey was not far away. We went to school with Cousin Zafar, who seemed less anxious to marry my sister now that we were children of a broken home. But his worst deed came one weekend when we were taken to the General's mountain cottage in Nathyagali, beyond Muri. I was in a state of high excitement. My illness had just been declared cured. Mountains! The possibility of panthers, cold, biting air! So that I thought nothing of it when the General asked me if I'd mind sharing a bed with Zafar, and didn't even guess when they spread the rubber sheet over the mattress. I awoke in the small hours in a large, rancid pool of lukewarm liquid and began to yell blue murder. The General appeared at our bedside and began to thrash the living daylights out of his son.
"You're a big man now, damn it to hell. Still and still you do it. Get yourself organized, good for nothing. Who behaves in this damn way? Cowards, that's who. Damn me if I'll have a coward for a son."
The enuresis of my cousin Zafar continued, however, to be the shame of his family. Despite thrashings, the liquid ran down his leg, and one day it happened when he was awake. But that was after certain movements had, with my assistance, been performed by Pepper Potts, proving to me that although the telepathic airwaves were jammed in this country, the modes of connection still seemed to function, active literally as well as metaphorically. I helped change the fate of the land of the pure. The brass monkey and I were helpless observers in those days of my wilting mother. She, who had always been assiduous in the heat, had begun to wither in the northern cold. Deprived of two husbands, she was also deprived, in her own eyes, of meaning. And there was also a relationship to rebuild between mother and son. She held me tightly one night and said, "Love, my child, is a thing that every mother learns. It is not born with a baby, but made. And for 11 years, I have learned to love you as my son." But there was a distance behind her gentleness, as though she were trying to persuade herself. A distance, too, in the monkey's midnight whispers of, "Hey, brother, why don't we go and pour water over Zafar? They'll only think he's wet his bed." And it was my sense of this gap which showed me that, despite their use of son and brother, their imaginations were working hard to assimilate Mary's confession, not knowing then that they would be unable to succeed in their reimaginings of brother and son. I remained terrified of Shiva, and was accordingly driven even deeper into the illusory heart of my desire to prove myself worthy of their kinship. Despite Reverend Mother's recognition of me, I was never at ease until, on a more than 3 years distant veranda, my father said, "Come, son, come here and let me love you." Perhaps that is why I behaved as I did on the night of October 7th, 1958. An 11-year-old boy, Padma, knew very little about the internal affairs of Pakistan, but he could see on that October day that an unusual dinner party was being planned. Salim, at 11, knew nothing about the Constitution of 1956, and its gradual erosion, but his eyes were keen enough to spot the army security officers, the military police, who arrived that afternoon to lurk secretly behind every garden bush. Faction strife and the multiple incompetences of Mr. Gulham Mohammed were a mystery to him. But it was clear that his Aunt Emerald was putting on her finest jewels. The farce of 4 prime ministers in 2 years had never made him giggle, but he could sense, in the air of drama hanging over the general's house, that something like a final curtain was approaching. Ignorant of the emergence of the Republican Party, he was nevertheless curious about the guest list for the Zulfikar party. Although he was in a country where names meant nothing, who was Chaudhry Muhammad Ali, or Suhrawardi, or Chundrigar, or Noon? The anonymity of the dinner guests, which was carefully preserved by his uncle and aunt, was a puzzling thing. Even though he had once cut Pakistani headlines out of newspapers, furniture, hurling sleighs, deputy EPAC speaker, he had no idea why at 6 p.m. a long line of black limousines came through the sentried walls of the Zulfikar estate, why flags waved on their bonnets, why their occupants refused to smile, or why Emerald and Pierre and my mother stood behind General Zulfikar with expressions on their faces which would have seemed more appropriate at a funeral than a social gathering. Who, what was dying? Who, why were the limousine arrivals? I had no idea, but I was on my toes behind my mother, staring at the smoked glass windows of the enigmatic cars. Car doors opened. Equerries, adjutants, leapt out of vehicles and opened rear doors, saluted stiffly. A small muscle began to tick in my Aunt Emerald's cheek. And then, who descended from the flag-waving motors? What name should be put to the fabulous array of moustaches, swagger sticks, gimlet eyes, medals and shoulder pips which emerged? Salim knew neither names nor serial numbers. Ranks, however, could be discerned. Gongs and pips, proudly worn on chests and shoulders, announced the arrival of very top brass indeed. And out of the last car came a tall man with an astonishingly round head, round as a tin globe, although unmarked by lines of longitude and latitude. Planet-headed, he was not labelled like the orb which the monkey had once squashed, not made as England. Although certainly Sandhurst strained, he moved through saluting gongs and pips, arrived at my Aunt Emerald, and added his own salute to the rest. "Mr. Commander-in-Chief," my aunt said, "be welcome at our home."
"Emerald, Emerald," came from the mouth set in the earth-shaped head,
the mouth positioned immediately beneath a neat moustache.
"Why such formality, such talk-aloof?" Whereupon she embraced him with, "Well then, Ayub, you're looking wonderful."
He was a general then, though field marshalship was not far away. We followed him into the house. We watched him drink water and laugh loudly. At dinner we watched him again, saw how he ate like a peasant, so that his moustache became stained with gravy.
"Listen, Em," he said, "always such preparations when I come. But I'm only a simple soldier. Dal and rice from your kitchens would be a feast for me."
"A soldier, sir," my aunt replied, "but simple never, not once." Long trousers qualified me to sit at table next to Cousin Zafar, surrounded by gongs and pips. 10 years, however, placed us both under an obligation to be silent. General Zulfikar told me in a military hiss,
"One peep out of Hugh, and you're off to the guardhouse. If you want to stay, stay mum. Got it?"
Staying mum, Zafar and I were free to look and listen. But Zafar, unlike me, was not trying to prove himself worthy of his name.